And welcome, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Just quickly go over. We'll have you do an opening statement, and then we'll be opening the floor up for questions. And when we are almost to the 45 minutes, we'll stop our questions, and you can make your closing statement at that time. So do you have any questions yourself right now?
I may not have a closing statement, but that's fine. I'd be sick of me by then anyway.
Well, anyway, thank you for. Did you come down last night already?
I came down last night. I got word the weather might be bad, and so I stayed at the little Kelly Inn, and I probably had the shortest commute of any of you.
Very smart.
Did you check out of your room?
Yeah.
Maybe I can get yours because I need that one tonight.
I don't think you were very busy. You weren't very busy.
Very good. Well, the floor is yours.
All right. Thank you for allowing me to be here today. I'm honored and thrilled to have the chance to come before you. I will tell you that I've always been one that was more concerned that a job get done correctly and properly than I was about getting the credit for getting the job accomplished. I understand today I need to tell you about myself and why I believe that I am well qualified for this position. However, I want you to know talking about myself is something I'm not real comfortable doing. As a teenager, I was contemplating a career as a baseball coach when my father died. I had a choice, but out of family commitment, I chose to take over and operate our family mortuary in Alexandria. It turned out to be a good decision because it turned out that I had the skill set necessary to successfully operate a mortuary in a small community. The coaching bug never left me, and I founded Amerisport International, a sports travel company that operated basketball and volleyball tournaments in tourist destinations across the United States and Europe for NCAA Division II and Division III teams. For those of you who really know sports, think of the Maui Classic for smaller colleges. That company and the contacts made through it led me to be the founder of the International Basketball Association, a professional basketball minor league which operated from 1995 to 2001. At that time, the International Basketball Association, which had teams in both the U.S. and Canada, was the second largest professional league in North America, second only to the NBA. I've been invited and did testify before the United States Congressional Subcommittee on Small Business as to the state of the economy in rural America. I've served on all kinds of civic and corporate boards in my hometown of Alexandria. They range from being Little League president to serving on the Economic Development Commission to the Chamber of Commerce to the School District Education Foundation. I have a deep appreciation for agriculture, as my great-uncle, T.A. Dad Erickson, was credited as the founder of 4-H. He was working at the University of Minnesota, establishing university farm metrics 2 years prior to the Smith-Lever Act of 1914, mandating extension services at land-grant institutions. I've also served on several corporate, policy, and governing boards, including Wells Fargo Bank Alexandria and Knute Nelson in Alexandria. Knute Nelson, of which I have served for 3 years as chairman, is a healthcare company and is one of our city's major employers, employing over 500 people with a budget of about $30 million and serving almost 5,000 patients annually. It doesn't matter if it's a Little League board with a budget of $30,000, Knute Nelson with a budget of $30 million, or the University of Minnesota with a budget of $3 billion. I believe I have the experience necessary to make the necessary assessments, look at the long-term visions, and make the value judgments that need to be made in a board setting. I love a lot of what is going on at the University of Minnesota. The Venture Center is submitting one patent every other day and bringing in about $40 million in royalty revenue annually. The University of Minnesota hospitals are billing $1.4 billion annually, and the University of Minnesota Foundation is bringing in about $280 million in philanthropy. On top of that, we're continuing to educate about 41,000 undergraduates and 63,000 total students at any given time. However, those numbers are just the statistics. What they neglect to tell is the significance beyond the numbers to everyday Minnesotans. They don't tell of the Venture Center backing an invention that could provide 500 jobs in a small Minnesota community. They don't tell of the University of Minnesota Hospital research that allowed for a liver transplant, allowing a mother and grandmother 10 more years with her loved ones. And they don't tell the $10 million in nursing scholarships to help fill an urgent and worsening shortage of healthcare workers in underserved and rural areas of Minnesota. Those are the results that the University of Minnesota can deliver in the lives of everyday Minnesotans. As a regent, I would do everything in my power to make sure that as a policy board, we continue to see the human side of the issues for our university beyond the numbers. You see, the University of Minnesota played a significant role in my life. In 1963, I had life-saving heart surgery under the direct care of Dr. C. Walton Lillehei, the namesake of the Lillehei Heart Institute. It may have been the only hospital in the country, but the opportunity was available to me because of the research they were doing. Since that time, I've been a part of the university as a patient, a student, a graduate, an alumni, a donor, a season ticket holder, and as a spokesman in the University of Minnesota Foundation Fund Drive Appeals. I'm experienced, yet I'm young and energetic. I'm also fortunate enough to be able to give a full-time commitment to the office of regent. I'm not here today to build a resume. I'm not here today to cap off a career. I've never ran for public office. I don't intend to. I'm here today simply because I believe the circumstances in my life, my business and board experience, my sound reasoning, vision, and judgment can be used to help the University of Minnesota be relevant. Everyday Minnesotans can make a significant difference in their lives. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jerry, would you give the first question?
Thank you for being here, Mr. Anderson. I'm impressed by the background you give us. As I'm reading through your application, one of the questions you, or one of the things that you mentioned that, let me quote, you believe outweighing all other issues is the idea we must be able to provide access and affordability to the institution for the people of the state of Minnesota. I'd like to have you expand a little bit, and you do mention that we can't cut our way to prosperity. We have to find some other way of doing that. I want you to expand and tell me what some of the ideas you have to find our way to prosperity without cutting.
Okay, in the very knowledge that I have and some of the brief things I've thought, I think in our area of the world, and certainly in Moorhead, you know this, we are deluged. The quotas are moving west. Our kids are getting enticed to go to UND, NDSU, South Dakota State. It's a little less expensive. I think we have to be competitive with those colleges. Some of the ways I think we can help, I've always found in business, the easiest way to bring in more money was to expand the things that you did well. Talk about philanthropy. University of Minnesota raised $280 million in philanthropy last year from 75,000 people. It's in a piece they sent out. 75,000 people is a lot of people, but it's only 1.3% of Minnesotans. If we could raise that to 2%, the same ratio, we could raise another $140 million. Talk about billing $1.4 billion in health care from the university hospitals. One of the problems we have is we only collect from our health insurance people 55% of that with a 45% discount. The Mayo Clinic collects 81%. They do a much better job at that than we do. They've got a brand, they've got a name. But there are other hospitals. Park Nicollet collects 24% or 76%. We're kind of almost with Hennepin County, Minnesota, where they collect about 50%. I think if we could move that needle from collecting 55% to collecting 58% on $1.4 billion, that's another $42 million we can bring. We've done that at Canute Nelson. We went to our health care providers and said, listen, we're getting people out of the nursing home here for therapy in 4 days, and your average is six. We would like to, we can save you 2 days. Can we share that revenue with you? Well, last year we got a check from Prime West, which is our biggest people, for about $231,000 for doing that on a rebate basis. So those, I don't think we can cut costs. We got a University of Minnesota, there probably is ways we can cut, but I like to enhance the revenue side. Fair answer?
It's a very fair answer. Thank you.
Pat has a follow-up.
I have a follow-up relating to your comment about some of the best and the brightest kids being enticed to go to the Dakotas. I'm from South Central Minnesota, so our kids get enticed to go to not only NDSU and SDSU, but Iowa State, and more kids go to Madison, it seems like, than come to the U of M. And Those are all great schools. What difference does it make?
What difference does it make where they go, or what difference does it make to us in Minnesota? Okay,
so these are, I'm going to say these are bright kids,
yep.
And they're getting a great education. Is that okay?
I think it's okay, yeah. You know, there's 6,000 seniors that leave Minnesota a year. Approximately 3,000 go to the Wisconsin schools, and approximately 3,000 go to the Dakota schools. I look at the proximity and the number of kids you have in the metro area here, just anecdotally, it looks like we get a higher percentage of ours pulled west than you do east, is my point. Where they go, though, you know, I went yesterday and visited with an agribanker because I wanted to know the current price of the cropland and everything. And he told me, he said, Tom, tell the people what we need the University of Minnesota to do is bring scientists and the STEM students, even in agriculture. Those are the students we need. And I guess if they're going to come and work in Minnesota, it doesn't really matter where they go. I have a son who goes to the University of North Dakota. He's in the aerospace division. You don't have an aerospace division in Minnesota. Nothing wrong with that. I think he wants to come back and work here. But I really, you know, see the pull that it'd be nice to hold those in. But we really need them, like the agribusiness, is to learn the STEM scientists and cut 100-day corn down to 75-day corn or down to 50-day corn and do that so we can have two crops. But it's a real-world issue. On Christmas Day, I have a brother-in-law who is in Sioux Falls. They've got a senior in high school. He's debating, he's going into pharmacy, debating between South Dakota State and Minnesota. Minnesota is about, I think, a 7 to 8 year program. South Dakota State is a 6 to 7 year program. The cost differences are $25,000 a year and $16,000 a year. He's got a dad who grew up in Wheaton, Minnesota, and wants his son to be a gopher. He's got a mom who's from South Dakota and wants
to be a whatever.
Yeah, I think
Jack Rabbits.
But I think those are issues. Those are issues. But those are good schools too. If I had my brothers, I'd rather have them at University of Minnesota. Or Morris. Morris has ag stuff.
We are the University.
So does well.
Lois.
You mentioned the Venture Center in your comments. And to the grow the revenue piece, talk with us a little bit about how the university, about university IP, how that plays into the revenue picture in general for the state, and perchance put a little bit of frosting on your comments as to how it plays in for greater Minnesota.
Okay. I will tell you, and I'm an investor in a couple of companies as a investor in startup companies, and I really didn't know about the Venture Center in Minnesota until I got on this chance. I knew about the Minnesota Cup, but I didn't know that was sponsored by the University of Minnesota and stuff. Minnesota is the 32nd state in the union for startup companies. I think that we're a little far down the deal because we have tons of available capital here. I think whoever started the Venture Center in 2006 did a great job because they can line up with the patents and stuff the University of Minnesota has. They got real-world people, whether they're in Alexandria or somewhere, and say, hey, do you want to? Matter of fact, there's a company in Alexandria, Douglas Scientific, got about 60 employees right now. They are on the cutting edge of genetics in the field. So they have a machine that does the genetic testing, and they're selling them everywhere. Those type of companies, one of the things I don't see where I'm from, I don't see the Minnesota Venture Center, and I don't see extension, quite frankly, as much as we used to. I don't see, I think our kids need to know that they're out there. My goodness, I'm in that, and I didn't know the Venture Center was there. But we have people who have ideas and ways to make money on them if we can connect them with the university. One of my ways, you asked me the question about more money, I suggest that U of M philanthropy, the Minnesota Foundation, would put offices in western Minnesota, in southern Minnesota, where so many small family farms being sold for $1 million, and these people are gopher people, as a way to get philanthropy in the region. Does that answer your question? I mean, we have these people in the regional centers in Minnesota who need help.
The the connection of the fact that we have companies that can work with university IP in greater Minnesota is what you carry through with
correct.
The Douglas Scientific piece.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. And Margaret.
As you know, people check your references, and the strength side of your references fill a page. None of your references could articulate any weaknesses. I always ask people when I'm interviewing them for a job or anything else, what do you perceive as perhaps your self-weaknesses? And what do you do about it?
About my wife. I tell you, I don't clean the house very good. There.
You know what? That's not what I'm looking for.
Yeah, my whole life, all I've tried to do is be a people pleaser. And I've tried to take care of people. And I told Lois in the hallway, if people found out I was a candidate for this, I've had people come out of the woodwork and do stuff, and I've had to hold them back because for years, people would call me and say, Tom, can I use you as a reference? Can you find me Gopher tickets? Can you find me Viking tickets? And I always told them that. And probably the most humbling thing about this to me is all those people are willing to do that for me. I've got weaknesses. I mean, that's a tough question. I for years, I didn't spend enough time with my family. I worked and built a business, traveled and built a basketball league. I don't know. I'm just a team player in the environment of my community. I guess you've kind of caught me off guard. I don't know. I've got weaknesses. God knows I've got weaknesses. I don't think I've gotten better. I used to be pretty set in my ways. I used to feel a decision. I think I used to see issues in black and white. I see them in shades of gray today. I've gotten better at strengthening the weaknesses I had, if that's a fair answer.
That's a fair answer, and that's what you'll need on the Regents.
Okay. Harriet, do you have a follow-up?
Well, to follow up a little bit on Margaret's question, if you could change one thing about yourself that would help you be even more effective than you are today, what would that one thing be?
Well, better listener. You really give long answers to some of your questions. Maybe need a bit better listener. But I do. I've over time I became a big listener. I started out in a small family mortuary that really grew, and I grew other companies with it. And I acted pretty entrepreneurial in that. I made a lot of mistakes, but I did what was meant for myself. Once I got on like the Wells Fargo board and the Knute Nelson board, I saw a greater scope and that I was one of the people making the decisions. So I had to listen to, I could no longer say I'm going this way whether it works or not. I had to make the decisions with other people and see what happened. And I've gotten better at that.
Let's see. I'm on the Minnesota State Arts Board, and one of the questions that has come up there when they knew I was going to be here was there's a trend that seems that humanities are not seen as important as maybe they once were. What role do you believe the humanities or the arts play in the education of all students at the University of Minnesota?
Well, I grew up as a little kid next to a guy by the name of Murray Frank. God bless Murray. He died last year. He was at the State High School League. He was an Alexander choir teacher for me to run the State High School League. I used to get tickets for the hockey tournament for Murray once until I got my own. But I always look back when the Minnesota State High School League was started. Thank God they picked Murray Frank because it would have been sports ran, all that. Murray included the arts and the humanities and the choirs. I took a theater class at the University of Minnesota from a guy named Arthur Ballett. You know what? I never thought his name until right now, but Arthur Ballett, I could have cared less about theater until I had Arthur Ballett as an instructor. My wife and I go to theater all the time now. I have a son who's a jazz musician. Matter of fact, he's got selected all-state tenor in the state jazz band. So he used to play goalie in hockey, gave up sports, play band, which was a difficult decision for him. As a ninth grader, he had to make it. He was starting goalie for his class. And he had to make that decision, and he told his parents, yeah, you'll go back, do whatever you want. And after thinking about it over the weekend, he said, you know, Dad, I want to play in the band. And we backed him. It wasn't a great issue with the, wasn't so great with the hockey people. But Jack is 2 years in a row now, but he's state tenor sax and all-state jazz band. So we're excited about it. So I guess, again, I'm open to change. I was a sports guy, you know, and with my heart trouble and wanting to coach, I could never really play. I always wanted to be the guy, you know, truth be told, I used to get 99s on the Iowa Basics and please my parents. They were happy. My teachers were happy. But if the truth was told, I would have rather been the guy scoring touchdowns and hitting home runs. But that wasn't me. I didn't get to. But I sat on the bench and learned about coaching from the coaches, and I wanted to do that. And I did get to coach the league. I still do. But I didn't get into it as a career.
Thank you.
Well, so I'm the arts I'm fine with.
Alexandria has always had a great band.
By the way, I will tell you, if you haven't been in our new high school auditorium, it's probably the finest in the country. It's a new high school. And I buried Murray Frank last October before the high school. Last summer before the high school. And that was just, Murray was a staunch supporter. He retired back in college. And he never got to see it that way.
Joey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you feel specifically that your experience in the 7th District would inform the decisions of the Board of Regents?
I'll tell you that I kind of expected that question. And I don't think anybody knows the 7th District, quite frankly, better than I. I grew up in a rural district, which has now changed to become either deep rural or regional center. Mr. Duncanson is in the farm business, agriculture business. In our area, you are either now becoming a big farmer or you're getting older. My two uncles on my mother's side were dairy farmers. They farmed 22 to 25, you know, had every night. One of them died. Well, they both died, but one of them sold his farm. The other is leasing it. Their families are no longer in the farm. They sold or leased their land to farmers who are bigger. We don't need to tell people like the Duncansons and that how to farm. They know how to farm. What we need to do is we need to be there with the new, figuring out how to get 50-day corn and how to get the markets in Cuba open and those type of things. The deep rural, my wife is from Wheaton. Her parents still live in Wheaton, the town that's pretty small now on the western edge. Her parents will continue to live. But what's going to happen to people who are my age in Wheaton, as they're 55, 60, and they retire, they are going to move to the Fergus Falls, the Alexanders, the Fargo-Moorheads, the Wilmers, the Marshalls, exacerbating our health care employment issue. I've got a meeting tomorrow morning on the Nelson Board. We're going to discuss that. The 7th District is the first district is the same way. We just talked about that. That you have these, was once all rural, it became deep rural and regional centers. Those of you who are legislators, I don't have to tell you about the nursing home issues in the deep rural. You know, we're lucky in Alexandria that we can have therapy and stuff like that. The deep rural, where the only day we have the quote-unquote old folks care, they can't get staff. They can't get staff. Joey, the biggest issue we're going to have in the 7th District in the next 20 years is workforce. How do we get the people, as these people move to Alexandria, move to Fergus, how do we get the health care workers and those type of people? That's the biggest issue we're going to have.
Margaret?
Before I met you and I looked at your resume, I commented when we went through the looking at those, I said, you have the end of life continuum, because what it's about is before conception to end of life. The conversation on the national level, it's being talked about by the national academies, the National Research Foundation, and that type of thing, is life never ends. And the cost of that to health care, nursing care, et cetera. What perspective would you bring to the Board of Regents, who 40% of their budget relates to health care, and that is a huge issue? And I know this is a tough moral question that I'm passing, but the thought leaders in the world are starting to ask the question.
Great question. You guys have a graduate from the University of Minnesota by the name of John Hammergren, who's the CEO of McKesson Corporation. John and I went to high school together. He carpooled to the University of Minnesota with me. He was an RA at Centennial Hall, and now, well, 2011, he was the highest paid executive in America. And I know he has spoke at your commencements. But exactly, you know, when Sarah Palin brought up the death panel, and I've talked to John about this, she wasn't necessarily saying meaning death panels. What she was meaning, John has told me that, you know what, everybody thinks universal health care is great. He said, we do a lot of business in England. They don't like it when they're 81 years old over there and they can't have a history. They don't want it when they're 85 and can't have heart surgery. They don't want those things. I'm a guy, because of my history, never ever could buy health insurance until the Affordable Care Act came. I got it through my employer, but I have never once reached my minimum deductible, but yet I could never buy health insurance if it wasn't in a group setting because of the history of my heart surgery. So there's a lot of great things about the Affordable Care Act. I've talked to diabetic. There's a lot of things that aren't real good about it. Need to be changed. But I think this continuum of care, we've made tough decisions at Knute Nelson with we don't make... Those of you who are in the legislature know that we get about $200 a day for Medicaid for the old folks room, but we get $500 a day for Medicare if we're doing knee therapy. So over time, we have moved the Medicaid rooms to Medicare rooms, which I was the last guy in the world to do that because I always think we have a moral commitment to our community when these people need a nursing home kind of thing like that. But we're losing so much money on it, we had to get into where we could make money. Ms. Carlson, it's a big issue. I don't have an answer for it, but I understand that issue. I've been in healthcare. Dr. Dan Gary, who is the head of cardiovascular surgery and the Lillehei Endowed Chair at the University of Minnesota, has become a friend of mine. And they're doing all kinds of stuff with stem cells, and I don't understand the politics of stem cells. And he says, Tom, we can reproduce some of this stuff in society. I know they're there.
And just as a comment, I'm glad you understand that end of life. Most people do not see that in the health care continuum, and it will be the big issue over the next 20 years.
You guys have John Henry. I'll tell you. In the funeral business, two types of families that I deal with: those that are ready for death and ready to take it, and those that are fighting. My mother ended up the last 6 days in hospice, and it got us ready. There's time for that.
Senator.
Thank you. You spoke about the big challenge of the workforce, and I know that actually. Your high school is doing some very, very innovative things, and some people say, you know, has the model that the whole state should emulate. So with regard to the technical focus on that, how would you see your role in bringing workforce solutions, and what do you see workforce solutions to be? It's one thing to identify the problem.
Yeah, I think some of the workforce solutions are sometimes maybe a university setting or a four-year degree is not for everybody. A lot of people in my community make great incomes with a technical college degree. And I'm glad you talked about our high school. We're very proud of it in Alexandria. We've probably got the most technological high school in the country right now. Again, brings part of the philanthropy into it, in that they realized they could build a $60 million high school, but our people wanted 70, so we had to go in the community and raise $10 million outside of taxes. What you talk about in as far as workforce, there's two ends of the high school when you come in. One end shows a health club, kind of, for the community. It's got all these things. The other end, believe it or not, shows the technical college side. And what it shows, there's, I think, 9 industries in Alexandria that are purchasing state-of-the-art. When I was in school, they used to be woodworking things. But they're purchasing state-of-the-art machines to teach kids on, and that's a rotating basis. Every year, one other company buys them, puts them in, and takes them. Trying to get kids to understand that, you know, some of them will be the science, technology, engineering, math students at our college, but some of them will learn the processes of doing line work, if you will. I mean, it's not line work anymore. But they'll learn that and say, hey, we can teach that at the tech college. Our industries in Alexandria have worked with the tech college tremendously, in that they say, you know, the tech college will go to them, what are you looking for in employees? And then they'll put classes on that. We're in the same way at Knute Nelson right now. We're teaching CNA classes through the tech college. Certified nursing is the first step for nurses. And we're actually paying the tuition of kids that want to go. They're teaching it as a night school. And we're actually giving them, paying their wage if they agree to come to work at Knute Nelson for a period afterwards. So they're getting their tuition paid, and they're getting their, and I think we need to partner with, whether it be the Cargills of the world or the, you know, Jostens or whoever they are in Minnesota, to do that. We have some great Fortune 500 companies we need to work with. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, and actually that is exactly what we're trying to do, and that's, you'll see legislation that mirrors those ideas.
Glad I answered it that way,
then.
Glad I answered your
question. Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, thanks for being here. I first want to say that your opening statement was phenomenal, and it moved me.
Thank you for that.
It showed a deep, familial, multi-generational association with the University of Minnesota and your public. So it moved me. But I want to talk about the future. If you are to be a regent, back here, assuming you want to do a second term at the end of 6 years, and so I'd like you to think about the future and assume you're sitting here at 6 years in the future, reflecting on what accomplishments you've achieved during your term. And I'd ask you this question. What has to happen in order for you to be happy with the progress you've made?
I think we have to, on a financial end, and again, getting back to Dr. Rogers' question about the tuition and the South Dakota schools and that thing, I think a couple things. We need to work with the legislative body to get a stable source of funding for years to come. We need to do that. I think I'd be happy if we can, if you guys had a start on this with the tuition lockdown. You know, my son goes to University of North Dakota. Between his tuition and room and board is about $15,000. Perception, and I don't have a child at the University of Minnesota, but the perception in our area at the University of Minnesota is about $25,000 for that same thing. So we need to cut that gap, and it has to be done with state funding, it has to be done maybe tuition freeze, and they're doing a great job with that. I also think we have to be relevant, and we have to be market-driven. We have to provide, look to the future, and have these degrees that our kids are coming out wanting. In greater Minnesota, you know, the millennial kids all want to come to the Twin Cities. They want to come. We got to provide, if we're not giving that college bang for the buck, somebody else is going to. So I think we need to get on that. The Western Governors Association, which is not necessarily Western anymore, we've got Indiana and Texas in it, online, pretty reasonable. So that's, you know, we have to have the market-driven solutions to draw the students. And finally, I think need to be relevant to these kids' lives. And those are what I say: stable funding, stable tuition, and be market-driven where we're getting the students, taking them from some other market. That's
good thing. Pat?
Mr. Anderson, can you tell us some of the lessons you learned from running the basketball league? Not necessarily, I'm sure there were many, many things you learned when you were starting it, but as I'm reading between the lines, did you have the opportunity to end it as well?
Not necessarily.
What happened to it?
When I started it, I wished that I had seen Shark Tank several times, because they ended up giving a ton of equity away because these were pretty astute investors. What happened is I ended up going from being the leader of it to one of the board of governors. Part of my concept in the International Basketball Association, by the way, we had a team in Rochester where we used Rochester Skeeters, was you would enhance, and we were ahead of the NBA in this time, is that we would enhance revenues by doing group packaging. And we hold down expenses by salary ceilings and bus travel. No airfare. The CBA was national. I really wanted to keep it compact. We had others who wanted to grow it nationwide. We ended up having teams from Billing, Montana, and Mansfield, Ohio. And that part about keeping the revenues down was hurt. We always had an... About our second year, we made an agreement with the NBA. Steve Mills from the NBA office, and Steve now runs the New York Knicks with Phil Jackson and Madison Square Garden. And they supplied Alex English, who's basketball, he's a big star. He was our commissioner. We always said, we want to run this league. You guys pay the player salaries. We have no talent salaries. We'll provide a league for the NBA for minor league. What ended up happening is we got so far and wide, we didn't save any money with air travel and stuff like that, and they looked at it and said, no, if we're going to have a minor league, we want to be nationwide. We want to have a team out by Fresno where the Golden State Warriors are. We want a team in Des Moines. We were a little bit of a problem of our own success and part of a problem of a lot of big egos. When we ended up merging, two of the teams stayed in. I was actually a partner in North Dakota, in Minot, North Dakota. And it was a great, we made money for it of our 5 years there, but it was a great out for us because we said our revenue is $300. We can't pay for it. So we stepped in. Matter of fact, the mayor of Minot was my partner out there. But Bismarck stayed in with the National Basketball. Fargo stayed in with the FMB. Bismarck ended up winning the championship the first year with the new expanded NBBL. And one of my great success stories there, and he's a Staples, Minnesota kid and a Minnesota Morris, or Minnesota Morehead, excuse me, graduate. David Yeager from Staples, he called me and said, Tom, I'm graduating from Morehead State. Any jobs in the IBA? I said, you know what? They're looking for a guy in Bismarck to pick up towels, do this, do that. He called the Bismarck over. Dave is today the coach of the Thursday. Timberwolves tried to hire him away last year, and they couldn't. So we had successes. We had player successes. We had, but it is what it is. I mean, another deal I found out is the exchange rate between the U.S. and Canada. Canadians didn't like paying their league dues in American money because it took a 20% hit. And every time we had a league meeting, you knew the Canadians were going to say, hey, we're getting $5 Canadian for a ticket. We want to spend our 20% league dues in Canadian money instead of the 20%. Well, I learned a lot of lessons. I started that basketball league because I always wanted to own a pro sports team. It cost to own pro sports teams, even in the minor leagues, were millions of dollars. And I said, you know what? If I want to own my own team, I can start my own team. And that's all it is. Kevin Kramer, who's now the congressman from North Dakota. Kevin was the economic development director for North Dakota. I called Kevin. I didn't know him, but he helped me find owners. And so now Kevin and I have really relationship. But no, it was a great experience. Great experience. Found out it's not so much fun to own a sports team.
Big lesson.
You get calls when hotel room got trashed or something like that. It wasn't the greatest experience in the world, but I learned.
Well, Tom, way beyond the obvious pun, I believe your heart's in the right place. And any closing statement?
I just tell you guys, I would love this job. I'd love to do it. You've got a lot of great candidates. I mean, I'm just proud to be here today. I'm pleased that you gave me this opportunity. What happened? We sold our mortuary business to a larger company, and I'm a minority shareholder. And I ended up going to coffee with these older guys a couple times a week to stop in. And they said, you can think about running for a region. They love me all the time. Quite frankly, I didn't know the ramifications of the region stuff. Then I started looking into what they do. And I said, wow. I said, you know what? I can do that. I've got a deep history with the University of Minnesota. So I don't have any closing statements. I just thank you for letting me be here. It is what it is, and you people have tough decisions to make. I'd be glad to come down and work on the Board of Regents. I'll leave it at that. But you people have the decisions to make, and it's up to you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's wonderful.